precious bond between parent and child breaks. The adult doesn't always come out on top. A gifted student's own drama has a killer plot.
Shakespeare brings out this confession, the power of Shakespeare.
A jazz baby won't let anyone stop the music.
They call that culture jazz mania. They went insane.
And a damaged daughter takes lethal revenge.
That kind of abuse is a recipe for disaster.
When these deadly women fall out with mom and dad, it will be at their parents' peril. Fort Worth, Texas, 1992. 16-year-old Dorothy Marie Robards is an A student who has the looks as well as the grades.
Marie was just this kind of girl that teenage boys always look twice at. Beautiful, long legs, gorgeous brown eyes.
And every parent's dream.
She was delightful. She didn't talk back. She didn't argue. She just went with the flow.
Marie shares a tight bond with her mom.
She was very attached to her mother. I don't think you'd say unnaturally so, but more of a sisterly sort of attitude towards her mother.
They finished each other's sentences. They would chat through the night.
You would be fine. You would have looked the nicest.
Yeah. Hi, darling.
But there's one thing wrong with family life for Marie. Her stepdad, Frank.
Did you clean your room like I asked?
Marie didn't like Frank initially for just taking away her mother.
You aren't my dad.
Diverting attention from her to Frank.
He's a good man. Oh, I can't stand living in this house.
When her mother said, I'm gonna stick with Frank and we're gonna make this marriage work, the devastation was enormous for Marie.
If you don't divorce him, I'll have to leave.
Marie ups the ante.
You can go to your grandparents' house then.
And loses.
Frank.
She decides to leave the family home.
In Marie's anger, she impulsively left home. But then, as most teenagers do, she changed her mind and wanted to come back.
Her rebellion only lasts 1 week. But when she returns, there's no happy homecoming. Her mom and stepdad believe she's better off living with her natural father.
She had been basically, she felt, kicked out of her own home, away from her mother, due to this stepfather who she didn't like.
Marie's misfortune is a blessing for her real dad, Stephen.
He was excited that he was going to have the chance to be a full-time father.
Stephen's girlfriend at the time, Sandy Hudgens, remembers how he put his all into making Marie welcome.
He filled those shoes, I think, better than I expected.
How's your meal?
I don't really like beans.
He got a job at the post office. He began to take care of Marie more, buy her clothes.
But a father's love can only go so far, particularly when he lives in a bachelor pad.
Dad, where am I gonna sleep?
Oh, right here.
Even though she knew how hard he was trying to please her, it was a miserable life.
She was sleeping on the floor. She didn't even have her own room.
I told Steve that, you know, a girl her age really, really needed her privacy and how important that was.
Her dad was trying to get that for her, but Marie wasn't willing to wait.
I hate it here. I have to sleep on some roll-up bed.
Marie is desperate for her mom.
One-sided phone calls I overheard was her constantly begging, and her mother kept saying no, making her cry, hanging up on her.
Marie was dependent on her mother and would do anything to be with her.
I just miss her so much.
It just was more dependency than the normal teenager.
Your dad's here for you.
Sandy offers comfort, but is no substitute for the real thing.
I couldn't feel all of the needs she was missing right then.
The one place where things go right is school.
Even though her life was not what she wanted, and though she felt stuck, she still excelled in high school. And so she was an A student, and she was especially an A student in her chemistry class.
Now please be careful, barium is poisonous.
The star student is working on an extra special assignment. An experiment in depth. Fort Worth, Texas. Beautiful, gifted, charming. 16-year-old Marie Robards is a girl with substance. But this star student lacks one thing she wants desperately.
I'm gonna go now. I've got
her mother's company.
Please, I'm begging you, please.
She needed her mother.
Bye.
She wasn't going to adjust to living without her. She would do anything to get back with her mother.
Marie is hatching a plan to get home.
One day without anybody noticing, she took a little barium acetate when she was over by the chemicals, poured it into a napkin, closed up the napkin, and headed home.
The A-plus science student will conduct an experiment with the common school laboratory chemical barium acetate, a poison lethal to humans. Marie waits a week until the night of February 18th, 1993, when she convinces her dad to have fast food for dinner.
I'm gonna grab a beer. Do you want anything?
Water.
Sure.
Her father, who wasn't much of a cook, goes out and gets Mexican food, and when he comes back, she sprinkles a little bit on one of his tacos or enchiladas.
He did tell me it was too salty, but he ate it anyway. Steve was going to go to church. I talked to him earlier.
Stephen won't make the service because he's closer to God than he imagines.
Within an hour, he comes back saying he felt sick to his stomach, and then he went downhill in a hurry.
His girlfriend, Sandy, who lives down the hall, gets a knock on the door.
So I went on down there, and he was already in bed, really having a lot of stomach pain, a lot of cramping. He said, I think I've got food poisoning.
Marie's chemical concoction is taking hold.
Something is seriously wrong now.
Can you tell me what happened here?
I don't know.
Dorothy Marie Robards watched him as the EMTs tried to revive him and never once opened her mouth to save her father's life.
Paramedics begin a desperate race to save him.
Can you go outside, please?
Despite their best efforts, Stephen dies.
I really couldn't believe it. He was 38 and in good health.
Authorities investigate the death, but rule it a heart attack.
And just like that, Marie had committed the perfect murder.
Marie gets her wish. She is home and back in her mother's arms. But Marie's not the only one with a shocking secret.
The mother says, listen, the two of us are leaving. We're going to Florida. And Marie says, how long have you known about this? She said, for several weeks. I just didn't want to tell you until it's time to go, and it's time to go. Marie realized that if her mother had just told her earlier, then this whole poisoning of her father would never have taken place.
Ended up being all for naught. That makes it even a bigger tragedy.
Marie buries her poisonous past in college classes. But 11 months later, the guilt becomes too much to bear.
It's the speech from Claudius. Claudius, who murders Hamlet's father. And it's the famous speech about guilt. Will he ever be able to get over the knowledge that he murdered Hamlet's father? She sees Marie breaking down in tears and says, oh my gosh, what's happened? You wrecked your grandparents' car. Marie says, no. Well, you didn't murder someone, did you? Marie says,
my father, I poisoned him.
Don't be stupid.
And out comes the story.
Please don't tell anyone.
After all this time, Shakespeare brings out this confession, the power of Shakespeare.
He was great.
If Marie hadn't confessed to a classmate that she had killed her father, she would have gotten away with this murder forever.
I just really wanted to move him back with my mom.
For Marie's best friend, it's a drama too big to keep secret. She goes to the authorities.
When they redid the autopsy, they found the barium levels in Stephen Robards' blood and tissue to be 28 times the lethal amount.
Marie is arrested and quickly confesses, but insists she never meant to kill her dad. She just wanted him sick so she could go back to her mom. But the jury doesn't buy it and convicts her of first-degree murder.
Given the fact that Marie stole the barium a week in advance and held on to it, certainly shows a great amount of preparation and planning.
Marie was a smart girl. She was getting A's in chemistry. She knew exactly how much barium acetate it would take to kill her father.
On May 10th, 1996, Marie Robards is sentenced to 28 years in prison. The flawless pupil becomes a model prisoner. After just 7 years, she gets parole. Sandy is still coming to terms with the tragedy.
I hate to admit it, but I had a really bad depression for years. Thank goodness that finally went away. But I haven't loved anyone since Stephen. Haven't gotten close enough to anyone.
Few believe Marie was born bad, But the combination of desperation and immaturity creates a murderer.
For Marie, watching her father die a horrible, agonizing death was something she had to do to get what she wanted. Everyone that knew Marie said she was a good girl. I think she was, right up to the moment she murdered her father.
For teens, breaking the rules.
What Dorothy wanted, Dorothy was going to get.
It's the best night of my life.
Can be exciting.
She was pretty much running wild.
Dangerous, even deadly.
The press blamed this murder on jazz mania.
San Francisco, 1925. A new beat is swinging the nation. The provocative and, some believe, sinful sound of jazz. All the rage in the illegal speakeasies of America under prohibition.
San Francisco has always been a very fun city. In the roaring 20s, it was wild.
The jazz lures in 16-year-old Dorothy Ellingson.
Dorothy was precocious, and she looked much older than she was. When she was 14, she looked probably 17. When she was 16, she looked 19.
Dorothy's grown-up looks are her passport to pleasure.
Dorothy started drinking alcohol at the age of 12. It's not surprising that she was drawn into the world of nightclubs and jazz and drinking.
It's not only bootleg alcohol that Dorothy thirsts for.
She liked men. She liked all kinds of men.
Dorothy's philosophy seemed to be, let's dance, let's drink, and let's do some other things.
In those days, even the roaring 20s, it was still very, very unacceptable for an unmarried woman, let alone a 16-year-old girl, to be having sex. But for her, acting out sexually obviously made her feel good, made her feel powerful.
She was not concerned what other people thought or cared for what they expected of her. It was what she expected of herself, and that was to entertain herself and have a good time.
Prohibition officers have their eye on her, but Dorothy thinks she's one step ahead.
I'm on Tanganero and I'm 19.
Dorothy was creating a fantasy for herself and a false ID that listed her as Montaigne De Niro. And she was age 19, and that's the role she played.
Dorothy's fake ID meant freedom. It meant adulthood. It meant excitement. But she was way too young to have it.
She was charged with truancy. She was charged with running away. She ran to Los Angeles at one point to be with a musician down there.
Several stints in juvenile detention don't stop Dorothy's behavior.
It didn't seem to bother her very much, but it really bothered her parents. They looked at it as a real shame to the family.
Her parents are at their wits' end. They want Dorothy on the straight and narrow.
Where have you been?
She was from a very kind of law-abiding, respectable family.
What will people say? I don't care what people say.
Anna was a very staid mother type. In this case, it was obvious Dorothy was having sex with men. It was obvious that she was having sex with many men. This was upsetting her mother terribly. She didn't really know what to do about it, so the best she could do was confront her daughter.
You will behave, young woman.
But Dorothy refuses to toe the line.
Dorothy and her mother had a tempestuous relationship, and it got worse as Dorothy got older.
I think any mother of a teenage girl would have been upset that her 16-year-old daughter was hanging out in nightclubs and seeing older men.
Dorothy won't repent. Instead, She records every sordid encounter.
Dorothy kept a diary. It was a little red notebook where she put information about her comings and goings.
Went to Joe's party, met an amazing musician. He knows how to use all his instruments.
It was kind of a way to look into her mind. She talked about the men she went out with, what she wanted to do. It was pretty much focused on partying.
Dorothy's diary is filling up nicely.
She judged them according to their physical build and how they measured up to her standards.
But there's always room for fresh material.
Dorothy was so rebellious. She liked to be bad. She liked to be a bad girl.
Stop, Dorothy. You're not going out.
When Dorothy insists she is going to another jazz party, Mom Anna puts her foot down.
There was constant turmoil in the family. The fights between Dorothy and her mother got physical, where they would literally fight with each other over it.
I'm 16. I can do what I like. Go to bed.
Dorothy was furious. She was being threatened two ways, not being able to do what she wanted to do, which was go to the dance, and also the possibility of being arrested.
Anna wins for now. But Dorothy has a party trick no one will forget. San Francisco, 1925. 16-year-old Dorothy Ellingson is a jazz baby with a taste for trouble. She's broken curfew, the law, and her parents' spirits. But her plans to paint the town red hit a roadblock.
They went to bed angry, and they woke up angry.
You are absolutely not going out. I want you to get a job.
On January 13th, the fighting stops.
And start being a responsible
already
individual.
A petty juvenile offender. Dorothy is about to become a really bad girl.
I'm sick of all this fighting. So am I.
She put two bullets in the back of her head without giving it a second thought.
Dorothy shot her mother in the back of the head because she didn't want to look her in the eyes as she was killing her.
She won the argument.
Dorothy simply got upset that her mother was tightening the reins on her behavior. And she shot her.
Anna's life is over. For Dorothy, the party's just starting.
She went dancing. She was the life of the party.
You're sure having a wow of a time? It's the best night of my life.
She wanted to have her good time. She did have her good time. She danced for 12 hours straight. It's very strange behavior, but she wasn't concerned about the future. She wasn't even concerned about the past. She was concerned about the now.
But after the high comes the hangover.
Dorothy's brother found the body later that day.
It was kind of assumed that Dorothy was involved.
Dorothy, you'd better come with us.
Dorothy's arrest, just days after the murder, shocks the community. They can't believe a 16-year-old girl is capable of killing her own mom.
What Dorothy did, killing her mother, was at that time completely unheard of.
That was San Francisco's first case ever of matricide, of someone killing their mother.
Even though Dorothy confesses, some authorities doubt her guilt.
The coroner actually disputed Dorothy's confession. He said that there was no way that a girl of 16 could ever kill her mother. That was just impossible.
But if Dorothy's not responsible, who is? The newspapers of the day believe they know. They lay the blame on the mesmerizing effect of jazz.
The newspapers ate it up. They called that culture jazz mania. People got their blood worked up. They got excited. They lost their inhibitions. And they felt that it affected their psyche, that they actually they went insane.
Even though the press puts jazz on trial, a jury isn't convinced.
Dorothy killed her mother, and it had nothing to do with jazz.
The jury feels it's time Dorothy grows up. In August 1925, she's found guilty of manslaughter and given 10 years in San Quentin prison. With her wings finally clipped, Dorothy renounces her wild and deadly ways.
She always said she never should have done it, and she wished she could go back and relive her life and do it the way that her mother had asked her to.
She hoped that her example could prevent other kids from going the same way that she did. She advised kids to obey their parents, to learn a trade, not riding in fast automobiles with people.
Whether Dorothy really did a complete turnaround in prison, only Dorothy knows. She said the right things. She said things people wanted to hear. Did she mean it? I have my doubts.
After 7 years in jail, Dorothy is released and reunites with her father.
The relationship between Dorothy and her father, Joseph, was very strained. He was trying to be a father to her, but she finally realized that she couldn't live in that household. It was causing too much strain there.
Dorothy changes her name and tries to leave her notoriety behind her.
She spent the rest of her life trying to run from who she had been, but she was never quite able to.
In 1962, Dorothy's dancing days are over. The jazz baby dies at age 59. Family reunions are unpredictable events.
Bridget hardly stood a chance.
Get-togethers can strengthen ties.
I mean, he was her father. He's supposed to be a source of comfort and certainty.
Or sever them permanently.
She wanted to destroy the weapon that had caused so much destruction to so many people.
In the 1980s on Staten Island, New York, Eric Goodridge is a pillar of the West African expat community. A Liberian migrant admired for his business prowess.
A good member of the community, an interesting and active participant in the immigrant community.
He was almost like a political big shot in his home country. And he was respected in his community.
But behind closed doors, there is another Eric. One that his two young daughters know intimately.
Eric was very skilled at hiding his true nature. The community thought he was a great guy. His family knew different.
Eric believes in old-fashioned corporal punishment, but takes it to a sadistic level.
It was physical abuse. It was getting beaten with a reed so that it would open up wounds on her. Forcing her to take red hot pepper and mixing it with water and flour into like a paste and putting this red hot pepper into her open wounds.
Red pepper is the same element that's in mace, which is what police use to control crowds during riots. It is incredibly caustic. It burns nerve endings.
For Bridget, there is nowhere to hide. Not even when she's tucked into bed.
Eric Goodrich, he was a pedophile who was incestuous. I mean, I don't know how much worse it gets.
The abuse starts when Bridget is 3.
That kind of abuse is a recipe for disaster, for an explosion down the road.
When Eric returns to Liberia in 1992, 12-year-old Bridget is taken too. But the abuse isn't left behind. For the next 5 years, her torment continues.
Daddy, please no, stop.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Our father continually made excuses. I'm just teaching you how this happens, how this works. This is what a father is supposed to do to a daughter.
Don't touch me! Just move! Get out! Get out of my room! Get out now! Get out! Just get out of my room! You want to keep getting more
money? The fact that Bridget was abused for so long certainly had to contribute to her feeling that her life was nothing more than being abused. And she'd had it.
At 18, Bridget is legally able to escape her father's grip. Fleeing Liberia, she returns to New York. By her mid-20s, and with her father some 4,000 miles away, Bridget finally builds a life for herself as a security guard.
She had a job, she was making money, she was supporting herself, she had a decent apartment in a decent neighborhood, she had a network of friends. Despite the horrors that she was subjected to, she had made it on her own, and God bless her for doing that. She deserves a lot of credit for getting as far as she did.
But when she visits her older sister in 2007, old wounds are ripped open.
Daddy's here.
When Eric comes back into the scene, Bridget is absolutely repulsed and horrified and scared.
Seeing her abuser close to her niece triggers overwhelming memories.
How you doing, Bridget?
The straw that broke the camel's back was when she saw her father, Eric, floating around Carlene's daughter, who was 5 years old.
I think she snapped. She suffered a flood of emotions. For a moment, that little girl on Daddy's lap was Bridget, and she couldn't take it.
This is her abuser, and he's going near someone she loves, who's vulnerable, very vulnerable.
He barged in here. His family.
Bridget confronts her sister.
With me.
Their discussion reveals another terrible family secret.
He did that to me too.
Carlene is also a victim of Eric's abuse.
She had actually confirmed that he had been abusive sexually to her sister Carlene.
More chilling still are Eric's travel plans. When he flies back to Africa, he'll be taking his granddaughter.
That made Bridget realize that nobody was going to take action to protect this girl. And what she perceived was there were two choices. He could go on or she could stop him.
Rockaway, New York, 2007. 26-year-old Bridget Harris survives years of sexual molestation at the hands of her father. Now she fears he's grooming a new victim, his 5-year-old granddaughter.
In Bridget's mind, it came to a head between her and her father before anyone else was victimized, and that was her priority.
Bridget decides to confront Eric and scours the internet for help.
She had prepared some articles regarding the effects of incest and rape, and she wanted to present that to her dad.
But Bridget isn't relying on diplomacy alone. She has a backup plan.
She'd been contemplating figuring out a way to disable him from perpetrating the same kind of horrible violence he perpetrated on her and her sister.
July 28th, 2007. Bridget invites her father to her apartment. A one-on-one intervention. She wants him to acknowledge the hurt he's caused.
Psychologists and psychiatrists that treat adult survivors of child sex abuse do not recommend that the victim and the abuser sit down for a confrontation without professional guidance. But that's what Bridget tried to do, and it had disastrous consequences.
He was that little, how could you remember?
Of course I
when
remember.
Eric denies his crimes, Bridget snaps.
What? What are you gonna do?
When Eric Goodridge denied he ever touched Bridget, it triggered a rage.
When children suffer long-standing abuse at the hands of a parent who's supposed to love them, sometimes they fight back.
Let go of me, don't touch me! Let go! Let go of me, don't touch me!
Oh. Furniture was broken. She used a pepper spray, he's screaming.
Using the tools of her trade, a can of mace and handcuffs, Bridget subdues her father. Bridget smothers Eric's screams by stuffing a towel in his mouth. Eric is now helpless, bound, gagged, motionless. But Bridget isn't done. She wants to destroy his weapon of abuse.
She tries to cut his penis off with the scissors, and it won't work. And then she remembers, oh, I have those blades. And she comes back, and she severs his penis.
Amputation is not enough.
She wanted to destroy the weapon that had caused so much destruction to so many people. So initially, she burns it on her stove. Then she takes it with her. She calls 911.
Someone's bleeding to death.
Bridget calls for help for her father, but makes sure his manhood can't be restored.
Bridget was so frightened that doctors might be able to reattach her father's penis, she made sure they couldn't and threw it in the ocean. Goodbye, Daddy. Assaulting her father that way must have been a very cathartic experience for her. Finally, she was the one in control.
Paramedics arrive too late to save Eric. But he hasn't bled to death. He suffocates.
If the towel is pushed far enough back, it is going to be impossible for the tongue to extricate that towel. Securing it was going to ensure that the person cannot take a breath at all.
Bridget insists she didn't set out to kill her dad, and that her online research proves it.
She had gone online and she researched John Bobbitt, who was a very famous case in America of a man who was caught cheating by his wife, and she severed his penis, and it showed that he lived.
Cutting off a penis is usually not a lethal wound. There's a large amount of blood loss, but it's not sufficient to cause death. Bridget didn't want her father to die. She wanted him to be sexually helpless.
The prosecution isn't convinced, and Bridget is charged with second-degree murder. She undergoes psychiatric assessment.
Bridget did have a psychological evaluation by both the defense expert and by the prosecutor's expert. They both kind of came to the same conclusion.
That Bridget suffers from PTSD. Post-traumatic stress disorder.
Oftentimes, people who suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder have flashbacks to the event that caused them the horrible stress in the first place. And these flashbacks can be overwhelming.
Bridget's life story touches the jury. On September 30th, 2009, she is convicted of the lesser offense, manslaughter.
They didn't follow the law, and instead they followed their sympathy and their empathy.
Some of the jurors wrote to the trial judge saying that she had done enough time and she should be released.
I told the judge, "Judge, you let her out right now, she can come live with me."
But the judge is in no mood for mercy.
He reprimanded them, and he basically said, "You got caught up in a whirlwind of emotion. You showed mercy, I will show none."
Bridget Harris receives the maximum sentence, 5 to 15 years in jail.
She knows what she did was wrong, and she knows she needed to be punished for what she did.
She is eligible for parole in 2012.
If Bridget gets good psychotherapy in prison, she may be able to function well when she gets out, but she will always have the memory of what her father did to her.
These deadly women brutally severed their family ties. Marie Robards sacrificed one parent to be with the other. Dorothy Ellingson took partying to a lethal level. And Bridget Harris cut ties with Dad to save others. All three had very different reasons for turning on their flesh and blood. But the result was the same. They were their parents' peril.